This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. In the mid-1980s, there were two kinds of feminist art: works by women shown inside museums and clever protests staged by activists outside of museums. The Guerrilla Girls invented the latter, but these days they struggle with being part of the former. The Guerrilla Girls are a rotating group of masked female artists who call attention to discrimination in the art world against female artists and artists of color. They're best known for their witty, devastating posters, like the one from 1998 that announces the advantages of being a female artist, including working without the pressure of success, not having to choke on those big cigars or paint in Italian suits, and not having to undergo the embarrassment of being called a genius. But in the last decade, the Guerrilla Girls have come inside the museum, and their work is being featured in many group and solo shows in the country and around the world. And they're the cornerstone of the exhibit currently on display at the Nasher Museum of Art at Duke. It's called The Deconstructive Impulse: Women Artists Reconfigure the Signs of Power, 1973 to 1991. With me in the studio are Frida Kahlo and Kata Kollwitz, and they are of the Guerrilla Girls. Welcome to the program. Good to have you here.
Nice to
Thanks,
be here,
Frank.
You are wearing gorilla masks.
Oh, yes.
So we should point out that if you sound a little funny, it's because of that. Well, tell us about your persona, the people who you've taken on, the artists. Frida Kahlo and Kata Kollwitz, who are they?
Well, Frida Kahlo was a Mexican artist who was a very tempestuous, fiery personality. She died rather young, but not before she really changed the whole landscape of women's painting, and especially the kind of painting that came out of Mexico. And I was always attracted to her because I'm really a closet Latin trapped in the body of a Northern European. And when we decided as Guerrilla Girls that we needed pseudonyms, I was immediately attracted to Frida Kahlo.
How about you, Kata?
Well, Kata Kollwitz was a German artist who lived from the mid-19th century to the mid-20th century. And what attracted me to her is she was a total political activist. She made cheap prints that she could give to people as well as selling. She did a lot of work about working people, mothers, anti-war work, even a whole bunch of stuff about sex. I mean, she had a wide range of subjects. But she was an activist as well as an artist, and that's what the Guerrilla Girls are too.
Tell us about the masks and the anonymity, the fact that you're using pseudonyms. Why?
Well, in the beginning, we decided to be anonymous. I have to admit, it was really self-serving. We started out criticizing the New York art world, a small, clubby place, and we were afraid our careers would get hurt. So we decided to be anonymous. Very quickly, however, right away, really, we realized that it was one of the secrets of our success, because the mystery attracted attention of who we might be, and no one could put down our work because they didn't like us personally as artists. You know, we really were able to be a symbol for activists everywhere in art and beyond.
But actually, we were guerrillas before we were gorillas. We were guerrilla freedom fighters first, and that's the name that we chose. But after we put a few posters up, we immediately got requests for publicity shots, and we couldn't pass up the possibility of having some pictures. But we couldn't, we couldn't be in the pictures ourselves. So we were thinking ski masks,
paper bags,
whatever. And one of our early members, you know, as many artists, you know, she was a bad speller, very dyslexic. So she was sitting there writing gorillas, and of course she didn't know Spanish, so she wrote gorillas, and it was just as though the clouds parted, and we were being talked to by the spirit of all the dead women artists who died forgotten. So we decided that we would be Guerrilla Girls with gorilla masks.
And it's a great pun. It works out a thousand ways. But tell us about the origins of this, how it got started, and what was the event that really got the movement going?
Well, in 1984, the Guerrilla Girls began in 85. In 84, there was an exhibition at the Museum of Modern Art, an international survey of painting and sculpture. And this was one of the catalysts. I mean, we saw that things had gotten worse for women after the second wave feminists, a slightly older generation than us, had done incredible work about getting some women included. There'd been a lot of backsliding. And this exhibition of 169 artists had only 13 women artists and very few artists of color. And we were really pissed off. And an organization called a demonstration at the museum, the traditional picket line. Nobody cared. Everyone walked right into the museum. It meant nothing to them. And Frida and I were there before we were Frida and Kata. And we turned to each other and we said, there has got to be a better way. And we had the idea to do posters. We called a bunch of friends and colleagues together at Frida's loft and passed the hat around, put a couple of posters up on the streets of New York, and all hell broke loose, and the rest is history.
I think at the time, people going in and out of the museum goers, really believed that the art world was a meritocracy and that whatever was shown in the museum had to be necessarily the most significant work being made. And the public was afraid to ask critical questions or even scrutinize the art world. And so we sort of delighted in just putting information, you know, piles of information out there, one poster after another, and actually asking questions that were really hard to answer without saying, well, you know, the art world is probably very discriminating. Why aren't there women and why aren't there artists of color in our art history? Women, for example, had been more than 50% of the graduating classes of art schools for many, many, many years. And if you looked at what happened to them after they graduated, there was something in the professional world of art that kept them from succeeding.
What do you think that is or was?
Well, that's a really big issue. One thing we think is that there's a stereotype of the genius artist. And if I say to you, well, think of a genius artist, you probably think of, you know, a Picasso, a Jackson Pollock, a very virile guy surrounded by a lot of women, flinging paint around. It's all for him. And women don't fit into that stereotype. So we needed to invent new stereotypes and complain until people realize that that's not the only stereotype.
Actually, what we realized is that when women artists did behave in the stereotypical way of male artists, they usually got institutionalized.
Mm. Well, we'll talk about that. In fact, we'll talk about one of the posters that talks about being polite. We're not being angry in this particular notice. We'll talk about that and other posters as we continue our conversation with artist activist The Gorilla Girls on the state of things from North Carolina Public Radio, broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Please stay with us. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Today we're talking about the evolution of feminist art with artist and activist the Gorilla Girls. The Gorilla Girls wear gorilla masks to protect their anonymity, and they assume the names of famous dead female artists. Frida Kahlo and Kata Kollwitz are here today, and they're in town as part of the exhibit currently on display at the National Museum of Art at Duke University. It's called The Deconstructive Impulse, Women Artists Reconfigure the Signs of Power, 1973 to 1991. We talked just before the break about, we were talking about posters that you used initially to draw attention to discrimination in the art world against women, women of color. And it seems to me that as you read those posters now and some of the other work that was done as part of the demonstration, it really is satiric. And it's about subversion. I mean, I think in particular about a video you did about we're not being angry. This isn't an angry screed.
Well, actually, we said we're not angry. We're pissed. It's not nice to be angry. Good girls aren't angry. We're pissed.
But that's something we've always done. We've always twisted things around and tried to present them differently. And if you think of our early posters, everyone said, we don't want to hear women complaining. What are you complaining for? So we thought, okay, we are going to make it our life's work to complain, but we're going to do it creatively. And our I'm Not Angry piece is kind of in that vein. Okay, women are supposed to be nice and sweet. So we are going to do a performance thing that says, I'm not angry. And then each person in the group tells what they're really angry about. They're saying they're not angry. Yeah. It's just like the advantages of being a woman artist is really the disadvantages, satirically and humorously put together to sound like the advantages.
Is there something about that falls within the stereotype as well, that women are not the extroverts, that in order for women to get the message across, It needs to be a kind of subversion.
Outsider, women artists were always outsiders. So we, the only way we could break into the system was to break through, you know, all of the barriers. And I think that that was an important thing that we had to do, and we had to confront power to do that. We could not play along with power. We had to confront power, and we had to mock it, and we had to ridicule it, and we had to embarrass it. You know, our early posters embarrassed a lot of people. And we always had this hope that every day gallery owners would get up and try to, they'd say to themselves, what can I do today to make sure I'm not on the next Guerrilla Girl poster?
Was it important? How effective has this movement been, do you think?
Well, I think it's been quite effective, and also effective in other ways completely. I think it has made people in the art world count. They were trying to hide out from the idea, but now it's pretty hard to do an exhibition without the work of women and artists of color and not at least be aware of it. And if you were a curator and not aware of it, believe me, you're going to get a whole bunch of letters about it right away. I will say, though, that we've never just been concerned with a piece of the pie. We've certainly had members who wanted to be successful in the art system, but a lot of us have also just wanted to break the art system, destroy it, expose it, you know, as Frida just said. So one of our big successes is really just to be a model of being your own crazy kind of activism. And as we see today, that's so important. We're not the only ones sending that message, and we're not the only ones doing that. There's an incredible growing movement of culture jammers, each of who do things in their completely own way.
Going back for just a minute, I think there was a time when we started when a lot of people in the art world, even people with progressive attitudes, did not know how to explain the fact that there was an art history that, you know, of American art that excluded women and artists of color. I think now it's a no-brainer. We all realize that you cannot write a history of American culture without all the voices that constitute that culture. But it took 20 years for us to, well, us and, you know, many other, you know, scholars and activists to really drive that home so that, you know, the person on the street, you know, if you said, well, there are no African-American artists in the National Gallery of Art, they'd say, well, that's shocking. That's awful. But it is the fact.
Right. And so, and then the question becomes whether or not it's part of a systemic movement, an effort, even if it's a subconscious effort, or if those artists just weren't good enough. It does raise this question, though. If we've got us counting now, and you talked earlier about the image of art, the art world as a meritocracy. There's some subjective judgment tells us this is good, that's not, regardless of who painted it. But now you're asking us to start counting. That again doesn't necessarily bring us to the quality of the art. Now we're looking for some kind of equivalence in the numbers.
We couldn't disagree with that more. I mean, we feel there's no lack of great artists out there. There never has been, and there never will be. You can't stop people from making art, and there's an amazing amount by an amazing diverse group of people. The problem is that the system is corrupt. Now, museums in this country are funded by wealthy collectors, and they tend to collect the same sorts of things. Occasionally, someone, you know, there's some maverick collector who has a whole different kind of vision. But usually they have advisors and they collect, you know, the top, what's considered the top 10, often the most expensive 10 of each generation. And to us, that's not the role. And then museums are showing this stuff. So we don't believe in quotas. We don't believe there should be 50% this, 13% this. But we know that since so many shows have 10% women, 2% women, 0% women, that is discrimination at work. And often it is unconscious because people aren't aware of how these systems work, and curators are beholden to them. They have to satisfy the people who are giving the money. It's a very sad way to present art in our culture.
Back in the late 80s, we did probably the first ever exhibition about a museum, and we did an exhibition about the Whitney Biennial. And what we noticed is that the Whitney Biennial, which is a show every 2 years, it's supposed to be the most significant American art, it was getting smaller and smaller and smaller. It was becoming more select. As the culture was getting larger, it was getting smaller. And what that is now, in retrospect, it was the market at play. You know, the market has become an Olympics where there are few people who win and everyone else who contributes to the atmosphere that makes the work is a loser. And, you know, art and history are not based on that. You know, I mean, history is a history. It's not a history of the winners. It's a history or the most powerful. So we were always attacking that. And, you know, as time goes by, you notice that many museums across the country have exactly the same artists. Well, rather than casting a large, you know, net and really telling, you know, the history of visual production, they go for the same winners over and over and over again. And that's not our history. That really is a history of the art market and the history of power.
Which results probably from the commodification of art. That sounds like it may be at the root of all of this. Mm-hmm. When we start putting monetary value on things, then there are going to be people who have the money who will call the shots, who will start picking the winners. They're going to be in the museums and create stereotypes.
This is the world of museums, and there's a lot bigger art world out there. I mean, if you look at street art, if you look at the amazing amount of work now that's on the internet by all kinds of artists and by people who do art but maybe don't even call themselves artists, I mean, there is a great democratization going on as well. But if you look
at... Is it? Now, let me ask you, stop right there, because in terms of the production of art, you're right. It's all out there. Do we as Americans appreciate art for what it can do for us outside of its monetary value?
I don't know. I would hope so. But I do think the fact that, you know, people all over the country turn on their computers every night, and they oftentimes see things and travel in the world of, you know, internet communication in a way that they couldn't beforehand, you know, they are empowered that way. And, you know, we've really produced our own kind of paradigm. You know, we're one of the few artists that you read about in art history books or are in, you know, major collections. We've never been in the art market. We've never been represented by a gallery. We don't try to attract collectors. We really believe in many, many small exchanges with people. You got, you know, $20, we'll give you a T-shirt, we'll give you a poster. That's really a new market paradigm. And while we are in museums, we are not part of that system.
Do you consider the theater and the posters, the art that you create, is that an art all by itself? The activism, the costumes?
We don't have costume. Well, yeah, I mean, we're performative, but we're not performers, I would say. You know, so I wouldn't consider us actually doing theater. Although we talk, we perform, we do workshops with people to teach them to do kind of activist stuff.
We wear gorilla masks.
But is
our
a
stuff
mask.
Art? Yeah, I think so. Yeah. I mean, I used to argue against that for years, just because I wanted to call it something other than art, but I think for sure this is a body of work. I mean, you can see it from the beginning. We try to refine it. We try to get better at it. We critique ourselves. We take on new subjects like pop culture, Hollywood, you know, female stereotypes, anti-war, all kinds of things. But yeah, it's definitely art.
Has the art world changed and the world in general? Let's stick with the art world changed since this movement began in the 1980s.
Well, the art world right now is global. You know, 25 years ago, there was this kind of idea that New York and American art was the center of the contemporary art world. Well, I mean, that was a fallacy then. It was nationalistic then. But now the art world is global and it's everywhere. And there's a certain, you know, wonderful multiplicity, you know, to it. That being said, you know, every culture, every government has a different attitude towards. So we just got back from Scandinavia where they don't have an art market. They don't have art collectors. You know, almost all of the funding for the arts comes from the government. And in some cases, they feel as oppressed by that system as we feel oppressed by the art market.
Somebody's got to write the checks is the problem,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
So, well, listen, your work was recently at the Museum of Women in the Arts in Washington, D.C. And I was talking to a friend of mine who was at the show. She went with her two daughters, and she said it was very crowded, but that nearly every single visitor was female. Is that a problem? Does that happen frequently, and is that a problem?
Oh, that's such an interesting question. You know, the Pompidou, Pompidou Museum in Paris did a huge exhibition of work by women, and they're a museum well known for hardly ever showing women. they had 2 million visitors. And there were a lot of women the few times I was there, but it certainly wasn't all women. Now, the Museum of Women in the Arts, I mean, that's a really good question. It may... I don't think there's anything wrong with having all women. I mean, you know, we love women, but it may be their constituency is mostly all women.
Well, you know, in a larger sense, we're feminists and we have a feminist message. And, you know, feminism isn't just for women. You know, it needs to be a male movement as well. So I think the answer might be in asking some men why they didn't go to see the show.
They didn't go see it. Well, and of course, if the stereotype, if you can't go see women in galleries, then for young girls in particular to go and see them on the walls would be an important thing for the next generation.
Yeah. I think it is. And we get tons of letters whenever our work is, you know, we're conflicted about being in all these major museums now, but we can't resist it because it gives us an opportunity to get our work out to a wide audience. And that's always been our goal. And every time we do have work in museums like the Museum of Women in the Arts, MoMA in New York, you know, France, Venice, etc., we get tons of letters from people, not just female, but many female, saying they didn't know this stuff before, and it really means something to them, and can't argue with that. You know, that's great.
And actually, a number of the most recent opportunities we've had to show in museums has also come with the opportunity to do a special project. And it's really interesting to be invited by an institution to criticize the institution. We first did it at the Venice Biennale, where we went over the statistics of the history of the Biennale. And we noticed that, well, the year we were in the Biennale, because it was organized by two women, the first time in the history of the Biennale, surprise, the highest number of women artists ever. Then we did something for the Istanbul Modern, where we looked at the situation of women artists in Turkey, and we did a funny kind of metaphor. We used the metaphor of telling fortunes, and we predicted that if Turkey joined the EU, things would get worse for women artists in Turkey because it was better for women artists in Turkey than in Europe.
And why do you think that is true?
Well, I think it's true mainly because art is considered women's work there. You know?
It was done in the harem. Yeah. By the you know, the concubines of...
So there isn't the prejudice against women's work that there is in the States.
In any case, we are doing a new project for Chicago, which we really can't talk too much about, but we could sort of plant some seeds of curiosity, and it will be out in March.
Well, we're a little curious, too, about what's going on at the Nasher. Give us a broad overview of what the exhibit is all about.
Well, it's an exhibition of work by women from, I believe, the 80s. And it was what's significant is that the women in the show take a critical stance towards culture. And that's why it's the deconstructed.
Well, I don't blame you for not remembering the name. You need a new title for this. If you're coming up with a poster, it is the deconstructive impulse. And it goes on from there.
Yes, right. They deconstruct, you know, the
say it three times fast.
Deconstructed. You know, it's about deconstructing, you know, the system of how women are portrayed. And we certainly were part of that. You know, the earlier feminist artists were more about expressing, you know, something about themselves. They were expressionists in a way. But this was a group of very cool, critical, you know, theoretical, you know, artists who did it in a very, you know, dispassionate and very laser sharp way. We actually are probably the hottest artists in the show because we're so absolutely direct and we want to knock people over the head.
Looking forward to it. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Frank. Thanks for having us.
Frida Kahlo and Kat Kalwitz are the Guerrilla Girls. They are here with me in the studio today. The exhibit, which is called, ready for this, The Deconstructive Impulse, Women Artists Reconfigure the Signs of Power, 1973 to 1991. It is on through December 31st, and for more information, you can check it out at nasher.duke.edu. Our program continues after a short break. Stay with us on The State of Things.